We'll hear argument now in the case of Menasha Corporation against News America Marketing.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. This is an antitrust case concerning at-shelf coupon dispensers, a product that Your Honors may have seen in supermarkets. I represent the plaintiff, Menasha Corporation, which is appealing from the dismissal of its antitrust insurance case.
Not Menasha.
I betray the amount of time that I've spent on the East Coast. I'm sorry, Your Honor. In the decision below, the trial court dismissed the antitrust claim on the grounds that Menasha had failed to support its market definition and therefore could not prove market or monopoly power. This ruling, we would submit, should be reversed and this case remanded for trial because the evidence in the record was sufficient to permit a reasonable jury to find monopoly power, and the issue of monopoly power should therefore have been submitted to the jury. Now, the trial court appears to have been under the impression that the only way to prove monopoly power is through market definition. As this court has recognized, that is not correct. Monopoly power may be proven through direct evidence of its possession. And here, Menasha...
One would ordinarily think that direct evidence of its possession would be something like a price covariance study of the sort that Jordan Stigler recommended. And your experts didn't conduct a price covariance study.
Your Honor, that's correct. But
in fact, your experts didn't conduct anything that looked like econometric work.
Your Honor, I think that the point that our experts did make, which is that, and the point that I'm trying to make here more precisely, Your Honor, is that Namath's ability to exclude competition from the core of the dispenser business, from the largest and most lucrative portion of it, which is the retail supermarket chain, shows an ability to restrict output and therefore is evidence of monopoly power.
How does it show an ability to restrict output? Suppose Goodrich makes a long-term exclusive contract with General Motors and prevents Bridgestone Firestone from selling to General Motors. That wouldn't restrict output. It is, as economists would say, just the outcome of competition for the contract.
Your Honor,
no economist who I would say the existence of exclusive contracts shows a restriction of output. It just shows exclusive contracts.
Your Honor, we're not suggesting that any exclusive contract or any single exclusive contract would show the ability to restrict output. But that's not what we have here. What we have here are a series of exclusive contracts which prevent our client from getting the necessary inputs to compete on one level in the market. The analogy would be...
Let me ask you the question a different way. You don't have any econometric evidence. Do you have any theory about why the manufacturers and the supermarkets seem so keen to shoot themselves in the foot? On your view, the manufacturers and the supermarkets are setting themselves up for monopolization by signing these contracts. Why do they do that?
Well, I think, Your Honor, from the supermarket standpoint, their main concern is to ensure that they have customers coming into their stores.
All right. So they think this is in their interest.
They do.
The manufacturers. Why do the manufacturers think this is in their interest?
Well, what the manufacturers are looking for, at least when they're engaged in national promotions or regional promotions, is ensuring that there is a critical mass, that there is enough access to consumers that it is efficient for them to run these programs. So they look to make sure that they have access to stores that have between 25 and 50% of the sales volume, or ACV, in the relevant market. They want to jump onto the bandwagon, the network that is large.
They presumably want to do this at a particular price. I could assure 100% coverage by offering everybody a gold-plated Cadillac if they put my dispensers there. Right? You're not grappling with the question why they want it. The reason I'm asking this question is because, depending on how you view it, the consumers here are either the manufacturers or the stores. One or the other, or maybe both, are buying promotional devices to get promotions that they want with customers. And so far as I can see, when the consumers of a product are happy, and only the competitors are unhappy, what that principally tells me is that this is well-functioning competition. It's when the consumers are unhappy and the competitors are happy that one ought to be worried under the antitrust laws. But you've got what appears to be a situation in which the consumers are delighted.
Well, Your Honor, I would not agree with that premise. I think the evidence in the record shows that manufacturers wanted to be able to use the dispensers that Menasha and other non-revenue generating companies were distributed.
So why aren't the manufacturers the plaintiffs here instead of you?
Because, Your Honor, we have been excluded from the market. I think we do have the necessary injury.
No, you may not be getting the gist of it. The Supreme Court, in a series of cases, has said competitors are the wrong people to sue under the antitrust laws. We're worried about consumers' welfare, not competitors' welfare. The consumers can, of course, speak for themselves. Sometimes one worries about consumer suits. If each consumer is buying, you know, only Epsilon worth of the product, they don't have enough money on the line, right? These consumers are really big, substantial corporations. They seem to be happy.
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that they are being injured, that the prices that they are being charged, Namath has the ability to...
If they're being injured, let them tell us that.
Well, Your Honor, I do think that it is clear that a competitor that has been excluded from the market through any competitive act has standing to sue. Now, I think in addition to the evidence of the exclusion of these competitors, there's other direct evidence in terms of the pricing behavior of Namath after it acquired Act Media and became the sole seller of dispensers. And furthermore, we submit that the evidence of market definition that was supplied was sufficient to raise a genuine issue for the jury. Now, we submitted a variety of evidence showing that the relevant product market here is at-shelf coupon dispensers. There was the competition that was ignited by News America's entry into the dispenser business in 1996 and 1997. There's also the behavior of Namath after the acquisition of Act Media, made it the only dispenser seller in the United States, when instead of, when it was able to slash its cost, but instead of increasing its output, which is what one would expect in a competitive market, it maintained and may in fact even have decreased its output, which as Dr. Warren Bolton's testimony demonstrated, is characteristic of a monopolist. Other evidence that supports...
What he said in his report is that he's just relying on the market definition of Langenfeld. And Langenfeld's market definition comes from this, I don't say, preposterous survey. Warren Bolton, an economist, might have put in some, on top of the survey evidence, some econometrics about market definition, but I didn't find any of that in his report. I think I've read it thoroughly. Is there any econometric addition to Langenfeld's conclusion?
Well, Your Honor, there is no econometric data, but Dr. Warren Bolton did look to the qualitative evidence.
Very easy to find price covariance, if there is any, between these kinds of coupons and other kinds of couponing devices. I mean, there are lots of other ways to search for markets, but none of them other than talk appears to be used here.
Well, Your Honor, the question that's before this court is not whether the plaintiffs presented the most persuasive evidence of market definition or market power. The question is whether they presented sufficient evidence to raise a genuine issue.
Yes,
for
but
a jury.
If Langenfeld relies on the survey, which has been excluded as unscientific, and Warren Bolton then relies on Langenfeld, what's left?
Well, Your Honor, I would disagree with the way that you're characterizing the record. First of all, Dr. Langenfeld did not rely for all of his determinations on the survey by Mr. Tenser. If you go through his report, you'll see that the reliance is actually relatively slight. And the main points of his analysis, which are that market participants recognize and treat at-shelf coupon dispensers as complementary to other marketing devices, and that the dispensers have unique characteristics which are understood by manufacturers and valued by them, those points are not dependent on Mr. Tenser's analysis. Now, furthermore, Dr. Warren Bolton, although he agreed with Dr. Langenfeld's analysis, did conduct some independent analysis along of the qualitative sort that I have described. And I would point out that this qualitative analysis, with Dr. Warren Bolton in his supplemental report found very persuasive, was never challenged by the experts on the other side. I think that evidence is sufficient for the jury.
Warren Bolton says he relies on four additional facts. One of them is, for example, that the pre-merger competition between Namus and Eck Media substantially increased market output, specifically the number of stores at which shelf coupons were distributed. That just assumes what is to be decided, that that is the market. Right? Isn't that perfectly circular?
Your Honor, I don't think it is. I think it's the operation of the market in that situation showed that it operated as if there was at-shelf coupon dispensers were a separate product market. If it had been part of a larger product market, you wouldn't have had Act Media doubling the price that it was paying to its
suppliers. Well, look, suppose the question were, is there a market in radio stations in a single block in Chicago? And the proof were that at one point a second radio station had opened up its offices in that same city block, thereby doubling the number of radio stations in that city block. And the economist then says, that shows, since market output is doubled, that that city block is a market. You would say, I think, that that's a colossal non sequitur. Well, that's exactly what Warren Bolton says here.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, I think the very fact that we're having a colloquy concerning what inferences are to be made from the evidence in the record demonstrates that these are fact-specific issues that should have been submitted to the jury. But I think the situation, the hypothetical that you've given, is slightly different, because here the output would increase only if consumers, the manufacturers, were buying more dispensers. And the fact that the introduction of a new competitor led to an increase in the output, I think is evidence that there is.
Actually, it doesn't say even that. What it says is it increased the number of stores at which shelf coupons were distributed. It doesn't say it increased the number of shelf coupons that were distributed.
Your Honor, I think that is correct, but I think the inference can be made. Your Honor, I'd like to address some of the arguments that Namus has made.
I think if he submitted this to a professional economic journal, the referee would send back a two-sentence unfavorable report, and it would never be heard of again. This is not the kind of professional economic work that gets any currency in the profession.
Well, Your Honor, again, I think the question here is not whether these are the best economic reports, but whether there is sufficient evidence for a jury to infer that the proper market definition here is at-shelf coupon dispensers. And we think that Dr. Warren Bolton's testimony, the testimony of Dr. Langenfeld, the fact that both Namus and Menasha market at-shelf coupon dispensers as complementary to other marketing devices, not as substitutes for them, the exclusivity provisions in Namus's contract, which relate only to at-shelf coupon dispensers and which would be meaningless if dispensers were part of a broader product market, as well as the unique characteristics and uses which are recognized by manufacturers and valued by them, we think all of that evidence in combination is sufficient for a jury to find that the product market here is at-shelf coupon dispensers. Now, the evidence in the record also shows that Namus sells over 70% of the at-shelf coupon dispensers sold in this country. We think that a reasonable jury could conclude, based upon that Namus possesses monopoly power. Namus has contended that it does not possess monopoly power based upon the experience of Floor Graphics. We think this is another factual issue that is subject to differing interpretations. According to Namus, Floor Graphics has been a successful entrant in the market because it has been able to capture several contracts for retailers. But the market here is not for space in supermarkets. It's not buying space in supermarkets. The market here is selling dispensers to consumer goods manufacturers. And Ford Graphics has not been able to sell sufficient number of dispensers to manufacturers in order to become profitable. In the year 2000, their first year of operation, they failed to sell any dispensers. And in the year 2001, their placements in A&T and Safeway, which are the primary supermarkets in their network, were less than a third of the placements that Act Media and Namus had had in those very same networks, very same supermarkets. In addition, in the other supermarkets in Ford Graphics network, the placements have been even lower. As a consequence, Ford Graphics has been unable to generate sufficient revenue from its dispensers to cover the large guarantees that it was required to make in order to obtain the contract with A&T and Safeway. Now, Namus contends that Ford Graphics was actually just about to turn the corner, and that in the first quarter of 2002, it was going to become profitable in its dispensing business. But the only evidence that it cites is a statement by Richard Reb, the CEO of Ford Graphics. And Mr. Reb did not explain why he thought they were going to become profitable, and he didn't point to any evidence that they would become profitable. Now, the fact is that their track record doesn't support his statement. And the fact that a critical mass is necessary in order to compete for the regional and national promotional contracts, which are at the core of this market, suggests that they would not be able to generate sufficient income. According to Namus, it takes between 25 and 50% of the ACV in order to have the critical mass to compete for these national and regional contracts. Ford Graphics had only 7.5% of the national ACV. Now, Namus has used a different figure of 15%, but that figure represents the percentage of its ACV, and not the national ACV. So we would submit to your honors, and I see that my time is running out, we would submit to your honors that Ford Graphics' experience actually demonstrates the barriers to entry that exist, and therefore supports the monopolization claim of our client. What it shows is that this is a highly fact-specific case that has factual issues which are subject to conflicting interpretations, and they should have been submitted to the jury for resolution. Thank you, Your Honor. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Bromberg. Mr. Abrams.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I am Lee Abrams, and I represent the defendants in this case, collectively referred to as Namus. In order to evaluate the antitrust claims of Menasha in this case, it's essential to look at the business realities of the market in which they operate. Judge Easterbrook referred to the manufacturers as possibly one of the two groups that could be characterized as consumers. I believe they're clearly the consumers. They are the ones who are buying at-shelf coupon dispensers and other forms of marketing vehicles that induce consumers to buy their products. And the media companies like Namus and Floor Graphics and Catalina, which does the coupon dispensers that are printed out at the checkout counters and so on, call on the manufacturers and endeavor to induce them to buy the particular marketing vehicles. And these include floor advertising, which was pioneered by Floor Graphics, signs on shopping carts, signs on the shelf, coupons that are put in the packages and on the packages, advertising that's on the divider sticks, and so on. And these manufacturers, who are the consumers here, are gigantic companies. This is Kraft and Nestle and Procter & Gamble. And I'm reminded when I read the Sciuffi decision again, the case involving the movie theaters in Las Vegas that the Ninth Circuit decided, Judge Kuczynski said, the defendant here is dealing with humongous national corporations that have substantial market power of their own. And that's exactly what's going on here. No one is able to coerce Kraft into buying a particular marketing vehicle that it doesn't want to buy, selecting one rather than another, even though it believes that the other would get more people to buy processed cheese slices or whatever it is that Kraft is trying to market at a given moment. These companies control their own destiny, and they have highly paid marketing staffs that make decisions about marketing vehicles. If they want marketing vehicles to be placed in store, the media companies are dealing with the people who control a very scarce resource, and that's the real estate in the stores. And again, these retailers who control the real estate in their own stores, who decide what marketing vehicles will go in there, are humongous national corporations with power of their own. Maybe the best example is Walmart.
Not very much for what it's worth that Walgreens or Safeway or Kraft have any market power. And they're in competition with Procter & Gamble. It can't be that every large firm has market power.
They have power in the sense...
They're just large.
No, Your Honor, in the case...
They have lawyers. And presumably they can decide whether they're being...
They're utterly grateful, by the way.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
We're utterly grateful they have lawyers. Go ahead.
Thank you, Judge.
My point was they can decide whether they're being exploited and choose the competitive outcome.
Well, in the case of... Let's take the real estate in the store in a situation like Walmart. For years, Walmart allowed coupon dispensers. Then Walmart decided having at-shelf coupon dispensers would be inconsistent with its philosophy of everyday low prices for all consumers. It announced a ban on all coupon dispensers in its stores. At that point, no one, not Menashe, not Namus, not Floor Graphics, not anybody else, could put a coupon dispenser in a Walmart store. And therefore, it could not go to a manufacturer and promise that manufacturer that it would place the manufacturer's coupon dispensers in Walmart stores. The testimony, and it's uncontroverted, from the senior executives of the retailers is that they want to get paid for access to their real estate. Indeed, Dr. Langenfeld conceded that the retailers would rather get paid instead of not getting paid. And so there is competition.
Shocking thought.
Well, I got Dr. Langenfeld to concede it at his deposition.
Sure, you had to wring it out of him.
The simple fact is that the retailers want to get paid, and they expect to get paid, and they make their decisions upon whose marketing materials will come in based on who pays them the most. And so the evidence is uncontroverted that A&P conducted an auction. They did a matrix comparing the bids from Floor Graphics and Namus, and one of their executives testified, we looked at that matrix and we saw that over the prospective life of the contract, I think it was 3.5 years, we were going to get about $500,000 more money from Floor Graphics than we were going to get from Namus, so we signed a contract with Floor Graphics. Safeway did a similar kind of auction, except there the numbers were demonstrably bigger because Safeway is huge. Safeway said to Namus, if you want to be in the game, you have to pay us $22 million over 4 years. Namus said that's too high. They dropped out of the bidding. Safeway managed to get $28 million over 4 years from Floor Graphics. And in spite of counsel's suggestions that Floor Graphics is going down the tubes, there's no evidence of that in the record. I cite the court particularly to the passage from Judge Bork's opinion in the Rothery case, which appears in Menashe's opening brief. And it says that courts assume that economic actors understand the business realities of the marketplace in which they're dealing. Floor Graphics didn't commit economic suicide by signing these contracts.
Well, it may have. What seems well ex ante doesn't turn out well ex post. That's why we have the bankruptcy courts, which never seem to lack for business.
I'm not suggesting that businessmen don't make mistakes in their judgment, but so far as the record in this case shows...
I'm glad at least you didn't refer to what Kmart has done with these coupons.
I'm well aware.
It had a certain level of bankruptcy trouble of its own.
Indeed they have. But the Floographics testimony to which counsel referred from the CEO of the company, taken in September 2001, he said, within the next 6 months, we're going to turn the corner, we're going to be in the black. Now, he may not have been correct on that. We don't have any evidence in the record. The last evidence in the record regarding Floographics activities was taken at the end of 2001. But the evidence is that Floographics has been a very successful company, that they pioneered floor advertising. Their first procedure with floor advertising was to go to the retailers and say, I'd like to rent your floors. I would like to rent space on your floors to put ads, to call people's attention as they walk through the stores to buy Heinz ketchup or somebody else's mustard or whatever product it is. And the retailer said, gee, this is something we hadn't thought of, but we're delighted to give you access to our floors if you give us enough money. Floographics found that this worked out very well. They then went to the manufacturers. Now they had control of this resource that they needed in order to market their floor ads to the Crafts and the Nestles of the world, and they were very successful. And there's evidence in the record of Inc. magazine rating them number 39 of the fastest growing companies in the country. Having gotten their foot in the door with the retailers, now they said, let's rent some other space. Let's rent the space on the shopping carts. Let's rent the space on the shelves for shelf advertising, and let's rent the space on the shelves for coupon dispensers. And they did this very successfully. They got the contracts with Safeway and A&P, and they went out and marketed them. And Consul refers to the numbers that relate to the very first weeks of Floographics' actual placements. They didn't place any coupon dispensers in 2000. Their first placements were in 2001. Their first contract they signed with A&P in December of 2000. And once they had contracts with retailers, the essential first step, then they went to the manufacturers and said, now we'd like to sell you some coupon dispensers that we can place in A&P stores and then in Safeway stores. Menasha has never competed for the contract. Judge Easterbrook, your words in the Paddock Publications case are exactly pertinent here. Menasha, instead of competing in the marketplace to get contracts and to respond to the needs of the customers, the manufacturers, and buy access to the scarce resources that the retailers have in their stores, Menasha has sought to outmaneuver Namus in the courtroom instead. They have never attempted to enter into a contract with one of these supermarket chains or the large drug chains or the mass merchandisers that would give them access to the resource. There's no evidence that they ever even asked a retailer, when does your contract with Namus or your contract with Floographics expire? We would like to get in the bidding next time around. They said, and their own, this is their own words, their head of marketing, Ted Bonin, said, we prefer to do business the old-fashioned way. We don't want to pay retailers for access to their shelves. And one of their top salespeople said, I went into a store and I saw that we sneaked in under the radar there. We got a bunch of our dispensers put up in that store even though we didn't pay them anything for access. Well, the retailers didn't like having dispensers put up that they weren't getting paid for, and that was taking away the revenue they were getting from the companies that were paying them for the right to use the real estate. Safeway, for example, a Floographics customer, not a Namus customer, Safeway sent a letter to all manufacturers saying, we see that there are some dispensers coming, being put up in our stores that are not Floographics dispensers. That's depriving us of revenue. If we find one of your dispensers in one of our stores that isn't put up by Floographics, we're going to fine you $20 per dispenser per store because we have an exclusive relationship with Floographics. The exclusive relationships are what pay the retailers the maximum value for their floors and their shelves and their shopping carts. Menasha has chosen deliberately not to compete for this. And having chosen not to compete, it cannot complain that its success has been limited. It hasn't been all that limited. They've sold many millions of dollars worth of dispensers in a very short time. We disagree, for the reasons well articulated by the trial court, with the narrow, convoluted, and I would say gerrymandered market definition that Dr. Langenfeld posed, which is considerably narrower than the definition Menasha posed in the complaint. The complaint talked about all in-store promotional materials in supermarkets, mass merchandisers, and drugstores. Langenfeld comes up with this narrow market. Even if you take the narrow market, the evidence is that output has increased and prices have decreased. There's references in the Menasha brief to a decline, to an increase in list prices, but there's no showing that a single customer ever paid list price for a Namus dispenser. The actual prices, and the evidence is uncontroverted about the actual prices, are that in fiscal 1998, now I'm wrong by a year, in fiscal 1999, the numbers were $30 and some cents, actual price average. In fiscal 2000, that number went down to 28-something, and in the next fiscal year, it went down to 26-something. So we're looking at a decline in price of approximately 15% during the same time frame in which output is going up. Even with the convoluted numbers, which were the subject of our motion to strike a portion of their reply brief, the convoluted numbers there, which they base on estimates from 1997, choosing to ignore the information about actual placements in 1998, 1999, on through 2001, which is the last full year for which we have information, output, total sales by all people for whom we have data of coupon dispensers for all stores in the United States went up 13.4%. That doesn't include any sales for Floor Graphics, because we didn't have their statistics, and it doesn't include any sales for Out of the Box. Both of those companies came into the game later. Consul is right that in 1997, when the Act Media acquisition concluded, there was only one provider. Namus was the only provider of at-shelf coupon dispensers for a limited time frame from August 1997 until the middle of 1998 when Menasha entered. Then Out of the Box entered. Then Tri-Foods entered. Then Floor Graphics entered. We have not been able to keep these people from entering. From our perspective, Floor Graphics' entry has been successful in the sense that it has taken a lot of business away from Namus. They have, at last reports, the last information that we had in the record, they had contracts with 47 different retail chains operating more than 4,800 retail stores. And a substantial number of those retailers had formerly been Namus customers. Floor Graphics went out and competed for the contracts and competed successfully. And their first step, of course, was to get access to the real estate. Once they had guaranteed access to the real estate, they could go to Kraft or Nestle and say, now we guarantee you that we can put up your marketing materials in these particular retail stores at certain times, and you will be the only soup that has a coupon dispenser during the month of December, and you will be the only ketchup that has one in the month of January. And that is important in terms of the manufacturer's ability to plan. There's evidence that one of the Menasha people went to Kraft and said, we've got this wonderful dispenser we'd like to sell you. And the Kraft man said, that's great. Can you give me a list of the stores where you can put it up? What's your network look like? And the Menasha man admitted, we don't have any network. I don't have a list that I can give you. And the Kraft man said, it's been nice talking to you. When you have a list, come back and give it to me, because I don't want to spend money on a national program of whether it's coupon dispensers or floor advertising or any other in-store vehicle, unless I know what stores are going to have that vehicle at what period of time, because then I can plan my other marketing, my television and my radio and my newspaper advertising, whatever else I'm doing to coordinate it, but I need to be able to plan. And the only way...
these contracts prevent Donovan McNabb's mother from coming into a store and attempting to sell soup?
No, I think not, Your Honor. Each one is limited in scope to the particular marketing vehicle.
Do you think, by the way, that Donovan McNabb's mother is in the same market as these coupons?
I think that the television ads that include Donovan McNabb and his mother are in the same relevant market because they are ways that the soup companies use to get people like you and me to buy their soup, to call their attention, to call my attention and yours to reasons why that soup might be the soup I ought to buy when I go to the store next. And I believe the market is broad enough. But no matter if you took their definition of the relevant market, Namus does not have market power as evidenced by the pattern of output and price, output going up, price going down. And output can only go up, by the way, as fast as the manufacturers decide they want to buy this vehicle. If they decide that this newfangled thing that came along in the early 90s, an at-shelf coupon dispenser, is a lousy idea, there can be 50 competitors and no output because you have to have customers who will buy the product in order to justify output.
Yeah, the customers get no say in this. I would like to take a BB gun and put out the flashing red light in the Namus dispensers that I've seen. I think they probably cause customers to have headaches, but that's beyond consumers' ability.
I hope that won't affect your decision, Your Honor. There's
nothing to do with the antitrust issue. It's just
I understand.
General poor taste.
Well, there was some wonderful testimony from the A&P executive about the fact that if he had his druthers, there would be absolutely no in-store marketing vehicles at all, except, he said, I recognize that we have shareholders, and they're interested in earnings per share, and if by signing up with these media companies, we get a lot of money into A&P that increases our quarterly earnings per share, it makes the shareholders happy, and I get a bigger bonus, and therefore I am willing to tolerate the presence of the marketing vehicles in the store. I submit, Your Honors, that the failure of Menasha to compete for the contracts is itself dispositive, no matter how you define the relevant market. But I also submit that Judge Leinenweber got the market definition right.
Thank you, Mr. Abrams.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Bromberg?
Mr. Abrams has argued very ably the facts in the case, but this is not a closing argument. The question here is whether the evidence in the record, viewed in the light most favorably to the non-moving party, is sufficient to show a genuine issue, and we think that it is. I'd like to briefly address some of the points that he's made. First, with respect to this causation question, Menasha has competed. It has attempted to compete, not on the unfair playing field that's been established by the contracts negotiated by Namus, but by using a different route, by going directly to manufacturers, selling a low-cost item to them, and then having the manufacturers arrange for placement. This model was successful. Manufacturers liked it. Retailers agreed to place these until Namus moved in without competing on the merits and pressured the retailers into refusing to allow these dispensers and changing its contractual provisions to justify that. Now, the fact is that retailers, the evidence shows in the record, retailers do not want exclusive contracts. They would prefer to have competition. And the fact is that that Namus has power over them. You can see that from what happened in 1997 after ACT Media was acquired. The payments that were made to the retailers were cut in half. That's an evidence of power on the part of Namus. Now, as far as price and output, Your Honor, we think that, first of all, those figures are all in dispute, as we've indicated in our brief. But even more importantly, the big question here is, what is the proper baseline? Is it 1998, which Mr. Abrams has chosen for no apparent reason, or is the better baseline 1997, which was the year that ACT Media was acquired and therefore is more likely to reflect what the competitive output letter was, semi-competitive, because there were only two companies at that time. And the evidence in the record shows that output has decreased from 1997 to 1998, which suggests that Namus, when it became the sole seller of dispensers, did what a rational party would do in that situation. It went to the monopoly price. Therefore, the baseline that you're working off of is 1997, and the fact that output has increased from 1998 shows not the absence of monopoly power, but the possibility of erosion. And therefore, it raises another factual issue, which it is for the jury to decide. Now, we've talked about other entrants into the market, and there have been five other companies that have attempted to enter. All of them have been either foreclosed have entirely abandoned their effort as a result of Namus's action. Insignia, which attempted to compete directly with Namus, decided that it couldn't do it. It tried to assemble a large enough network, it couldn't do it, and it decided to shelve its plans to enter into the market. Menasha's growth
halted. Probably not the perfect word here. You shelved its plans?
Well, that may have been a somewhat inappropriate word. I apologize, Your Honor. But the fact of the matter
we'll go for all the humor we can get, intentional or not.
Well, I hope that doesn't detract from my time, because I do have a couple of quick points.
Now, well, you ran out of time about 30 seconds ago.
Yeah.
Your Honor.
We'll hear your final 30 seconds of points, because I interrupted it to make a humorous point.
But, Your Honor, the point I wanted to make with respect to the competitors is the Floor Graphics has been unable to successfully make a profit in this market. Now, Mr. Abrams says that they're a very successful company, but they're successful in the floor advertising arena. And the fact is that they did not plan to go into the dispenser business. They were told by AMP that if they wanted to retain the very valuable floor advertising contract with AMP, that they would have to supply dispensers as well. And we would submit that they are subsidizing their losses in the dispenser area with their profits in the floor advertising area.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case will be taken under advisement.